Blog Talk Radio.
Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio Program. I'm your host, Susan Larison-Dance, and today I am so happy to be welcoming back to the program Dr. Alan G. Hunter in the recurring series of shows that we've been doing. And I welcome all new listeners to the show as well. Dr. Alan G. Hunter is the author of 12 books, all very life-changing books. And these books include The Path of Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Life's Flow, and Gratitude and Beyond, 5 Insights for a Fulfilled Life, and many, many more. Dr. Hunter is a full professor at Curry College in Boston, and he is an expert in therapeutic writing. He started his career working with troubled adolescents, and he also taught prisoners in Massachusetts. And most of all, Alan speaks very much from the heart, within his work and within his life. He provides one-on-one assistance to people through spiritual counseling as well. And today we're going to be focusing upon synchronicity and the law of attraction, a very interesting combination of concepts, yet very much linked. And we are going to listen as Alan explores how we can truly understand what the law of attraction actually is, because there are so many different definitions and so many different ways of approaching what the law of attraction is. And also, how does synchronicity work within the midst of the law of attraction? How does it operate within the flow of our lives? So we will really be exploring some concepts that bring forward things from many aspects of Alan's work. So I'm very much looking forward to it. We have a live chat room open today if you are listening live, and I'll be checking every once in a while to see if there are any questions there. And if you're listening in the podcast, I do invite you to comment on the show if you have any questions. Please feel free to do that. And we do have Alan Hunter's website up on the show page, if you can see the page, but I wanted right at the outset to let you know that that page is Alan Hunter, spelled with 2 L's, A-L-L-A-N, hunter.net. And I do invite you to explore his work, as well as visit the page on frontierbeyondfear.com that talks about all of his shows that he's done here, if you'd like to explore that further. And those of you who have listened to all the shows, welcome. I know that we're all looking forward to talking with Alan again. So without any further delay, I'm going to bring Dr. Alan Hunter here on the line. Welcome back, Alan.
Oh, Susan, it's such a pleasure to be talking with you again. Thank you for inviting me back.
Well, it's always a delight to have you on the show, and you just have so much to share about so many things that have a direct impact on all of us.
I think so.
I hope so. Yes, you do. And today, I'm really, as I was reflecting on this show today, I realized how it brings in concepts from so many of your books, really. Even though you know, you certainly have written to me one of the best books out there on synchronicity, really explores that concept, and then bringing in the law of attraction here. And I was reflecting on how best to enter into this, and all that I could come up with was it has everything to do with the heart, everything to do
yes.
with the heart versus the mind. And so I wanted you to enter into this topic. Guide us, please, into how we can begin to live more openly from the heart.
Yes. Well, I think you're absolutely right there that, you know, synchronicity, the law of attraction, gratitude, these are all areas that don't so much overlap as intermingle, really. And it's very difficult sometimes to separate them out because they all feed into one another. But you've got the core of it, and core is an interesting word because it comes from the Latin word and the French word, which means the heart, because all of these things are linked directly, as you say, to working from the position of heart strength rather than mind strength or possibly ego strength, if we can use the word strength and ego like that. It comes from us operating out of the center of who we are. And many people say, well, gosh, you know, how do I find out what the center of me is? I'm not talking about the center of you that chooses a life path. I'm talking about something that exists even before that, because the center of each of us actually is love. We have a loving core to us. And when we operate out of that space, which is sometimes very difficult to do because the world is a demanding place, but when we operate out of that space, we invite more synchronicity into our life. We attract the things that are loving towards us, like energies attract. So that loving energy, if we're able to access it, is going to generate more loving energy out there in the world, which will move towards us. So yes, it all has to do with us working from the heart rather than from that rather more calculating, more cautious, more fearful aspect we have, which broadly speaking we can say is working from the head.
Yes, yes. You know, as you're speaking, Alan, I can't help but see the image, and I'm already bringing in yet another book very quickly here, is I see your pentacle from Gratitude and Beyond, where love
yes.
is very much in the middle. Love is in a heart, even in one of those images.
Yes.
And it's a powerful reminder. And I suppose one question would be, even though this is a kind of off-the-wall question, is gratitude. You know, how does gratitude help us get into that space? Can we bring that in to the equation?
Oh, yes, we can. And, I mean, this is right on target, because gratitude,
yes.
real gratitude, is a great door opener, or you might say a great heart opener.
Yeah.
Real gratitude is not when somebody gives you the correct change for your groceries and you say thank you and you walk out of the door. That's a form of gratitude, but it's not deep gratitude. Deep gratitude happens when we look around and we allow ourselves to be present in the moment, right now, right here, and we say, my goodness, what a privilege it is to be alive. And that
yes.
that's a feeling you can get to even if you are sick, even if you have pain in your body, even if life is going in difficult directions. It is still possible, very possible, for you to look out at the world and say, but you know, it's pretty great just to be alive and be present here now. And
yeah.
when we get to that real gratitude, that profound sense of, oh, there is something bigger than me and my concerns, and I am part of it, that is actually when we take the first of a series of steps to opening our hearts as fully as possible. And In that book of mine, Gratitude and Beyond, it's called And Beyond for a reason, because
yes.
that first inkling of gratitude of, oh, ah, gracious, how good this is. That first inkling leads on to a whole series of feelings that take us, every time we consider them, one step closer to the feeling of love. And not just love in the sense of I love my friends and I love my family, but moving us towards, for want of a better word, unconditional love, where we love what is without judging it, without prejudices. Gratitude, then, you may say, is one of the ways in to that marvelous space where we begin to notice the sorts of things that synchronicity tell us. Because when we notice that it's not all about me and what I can get, when we notice that, gosh, we're part of something bigger and more extraordinary than we can even find words for, when we get into that place, we start looking around and we start saying things like, so I'm here for a reason that has more to do with gathering dollar bills, paying taxes, and being buried. What are the reasons? And when we look around, actually, in that frame of mind, it's eminently possible for us to see what the universe has been nudging us towards over and over and over again. And it doesn't nudge us towards being mean to our fellow human beings. The ego does that. The ego says, well, he was mean to me, so I'm going to be twice as mean back. I mean, that's the ego, and as we know, that doesn't really get you anywhere. Like that old saying, you know, if you plan on taking revenge, make sure you dig two graves, one for your victim and one for you. So that ego space it only causes destruction. But the heart space is what is going to awaken us to the possibilities, to what we can do, what we can give, how we can be more loving, for want of a better phrase. And there are lots of opportunities, but most of us don't pay attention to them. Most of us pay attention only to the ego's response, which is usually, as I've said, somewhat limited. This is not news. I mean, I'm not just spouting this off the top of my head. This has been at the core of most of the major religions that the world has seen since major religions have been written down. And it may even have been there in some of the very early religions, which were goddess-worshipping and even animist religions. It may have been there, but we just can't be sure because much of that doctrine and belief was never recorded. But it's right at the core of Christianity. It is actually at the core of Judaism and of Islam, and it is there in the precursors of those religions. So I think we're not just spouting off into space and say, let's all be loving to each other. No, we're looking at the core of a recurrent belief system that seems to be as old as humanity itself.
I have a question for you coming from, you know, I came from a Christian background, and I used to often wonder about this notion of loving others as one loves yourself, and how so many of us are taught not to love ourselves, and also how confusing that concept can become, even outside of any religion, when you confuse loving yourself with that being egotistical. Like, that's a proud thing to love yourself. And yet, it's at the core of Jesus' teaching that, you know, love your neighbor as you love yourself, or even the golden rule, you know, which is in many religions. If you respect yourself, you can respect others. So could you reflect on that for us, Alan, the importance of loving ourselves and how that isn't ego, that's a very essential thing?
Yeah. Yes, again, you know, what a wonderful question for us to explore and entertain here. When Jesus came out with that wonderful statement that we should love our neighbors as ourselves, we have to put it into a little bit of context, because at that time, of course, many of the tribes and the races that were swirling through the Middle East were constantly at war with each other. And so this was a very unusual idea to love your neighbor, love your God perhaps, but love your neighbor as yourself. Good gracious, shocking. And today, of course, we have problems with that because modern psychology has shown us that most people, most of us, don't love ourselves.
Yes.
Most of us treat ourselves really badly. And if we need evidence of that, we could perhaps suggest, you know, all of the people who are engaged in self-destructive actions of various sorts. So addictions, compulsive behaviors, eating disorders, which in my work at the Curry College, I come across quite a lot of examples of those. Particular ways of not loving oneself. So we get a little confused about, well, what actually did Jesus mean? And I have a suggestion here because I think, obviously, the Bible existed in many forms and was translated from many sources, Aramaic into Greek and Greek into Latin and so on. And so a lot of change happens to some of the concepts. But it's not impossible to trace it back. You see, at the core of what Jesus was saying was a very old belief, which certainly exists in earlier religions, Hinduism, for instance. And in those religions, what was stressed was that we cannot make a division between our neighbor and ourselves.
Yeah.
Because actually, we are all products of the same divine energy, if you like. We are all human beings. We are living within nature, which is alive. And nature is not just our planet, but all the planets. So in some ways, what Jesus was saying was, love your neighbor as if he was yourself, because he or she was yourself, because actually we are all one.
Yes.
And we cannot say, you know, oh, I hate my neighbor because he's different, without saying, well, wait a second, you know, we have a lot more in common than we have that is different. We're human beings. We breathe the same air. We can eat the same foods. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what Jesus, I think, was steering us back to was this wonderful idea of wholeness, that when we look into our world and say, oh, I am not an individual split off from this world. I am vitally connected to every little bit of it. I am part of this. And that it's a mental aberration to say, well, I'm different. I'm special. I don't need to play by anyone. That's what the ego does. And so in terms of what does this mean for us, I mean, think of it this way. You know, whenever we throw out our garbage, we say, oh, well, you know, I'm just throwing out the garbage. They'll take it someplace else, and I won't see it again. But that's not true. Whenever we throw out our garbage, it still exists in the world, and it may be put on a barge and sent to some third world country or dumped into the ocean, and it comes floating back to find us. You know, we are not separate. We have a responsibility to see that everything is interlinked. When we pollute our air, we may say, well, the wind will blow it away and it'll all blow to Japan or whatever. How lovely. Except, you know what? That pollution doesn't go away. And since we're talking about Japan, you know, the Fukushima nuclear plant, which melted down there, that radiation spouted into the air and is heading towards the United States. It's actually heading towards
me.
The West Coast.
Yeah, I'm afraid
towards
so.
You. And
So
the people in Japan may be saying, oh, well, the radiation levels have dropped and we're safe. No, we're safe. But that's so bogus, because the same level of destructive elements, of destructive radiation, is still in our world. It's just happening to head someplace else.
Yeah.
We are not different. Now, when I was, if I can just stay on this for a second, living in England, thank you, because when I was living in England, which is where I grew up, the Chernobyl disaster happened, And as we know, we can probably remember the Chernobyl power plant, which is in the Ukraine, basically, what we now call the Ukraine, exploded. And people didn't realize just how bad it was for some 10 years. But it's still an absolute no-go disaster zone. Human beings
yes.
can't be there.
Yes.
And within a few months of that, in England and in Europe, people were quite openly saying on the news programs, I mean, the national news programs, they were saying, well, you know, we really think that that people shouldn't be eating, for instance, one of the things was people shouldn't be eating lamb. And we said, well, why lamb? Well, apparently the radiation had been caught in storm clouds. The storm clouds had drifted over Western Europe, and the rain had fallen on the fields where the sheep grazed, and now we had radioactive sheep.
Yes.
And the government was saying, don't eat the sheep. The government was saying that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and one of those rare occasions.
Yes. Well, and why aren't we here? I mean, actually, I don't mind bringing in some contemporary topics sometimes because, you know, why aren't we hearing that now? I mean, that I think a lot of people are concerned that we maybe aren't hearing enough about Fukushima.
We aren't. And behind that is that topic which we started with, which is we are all linked. It's not a disaster that happened in Japan and those poor Japanese and blah, 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 blah. It's a disaster that happened to have occurred there that affects and will affect all of us. You know, since nuclear testing started in the 1940s, of course, all human beings everywhere have now got that strange element, strontium-90. We've got it in our bones.
Yeah.
It was never there before. It's mildly radioactive. We are all affected by this stuff. So to get right back to what Jesus was saying, he was saying, I think he was saying, and my studies have led me to corroborate this, he was saying, you cannot draw a line that says, my neighbor is a foreigner and a stranger and different from me. My neighbor is exactly the same as me, and I have no choice but to love my neighbor in the same way that I love my hands or my feet or my nose, because it's part of me, because we are all together. And that's an understanding that goes a lot deeper, I think, than just, oh, be nice to your neighbor. Because then you get into discussions of, well, you know, he doesn't live in my neighborhood, so I don't have to be nice to him. Is that right? No. We are all neighbors. This really is kind of a global village, to use that buzzword from the 90s.
It truly is. And, you know, as you're speaking, there's yet another concept that's coming up for me that's very much related, is that all of this radiation is coming towards us, and sometimes things seem to happen that's rather adverse. You know, I personally and many of my friends and, you know, family, we don't want to be affected by this. I wouldn't want anyone in the world to be affected. And this business of, this is not something we would want. And yet, it's happening. It's happening.
Yeah.
And it's happening. At a global level, and it can be very personal. What I'm seeing is this cascading all the way, you know, to me as a person or anyone else in the world that's affected, going all the way up to or out to everyone in that, why
everyone,
have we brought this about? Why is this happening? We tend to ask why, and how does that relate to what we're all attracting and where we need to go in this world?
Yes. Well, if we can look at this nuclear pollution, at any sort of pollution, because there is plenty of it to go around, what we can say is that thinking like that, thinking that it's okay to pollute, comes from the mind space of the ego.
Yes.
And the ego says, this is my land, I can detonate nuclear bombs on it or dump waste on it, or this is my land, I can do what I want with it.
Yeah.
That's the ego saying, I can. if we flip that around and say, actually, that land was here a long time before you were born, and it's going to be there a long time after you're dead, you are not the owner of that land. So flip it around and you realize you are the custodian or the person who is passing through that land. Your job is perhaps, or our job is perhaps, to respect it, to enjoy it, to learn from it, and not to say, well, I think I'll just dump all of my toxic waste there. Because that's exactly what we've been doing for several hundred years. For several hundred years, we have been treating the land as something we can just take from. And as we know, third world countries would often get very rich by taking the sort of waste that we had that we didn't know what to do with and buying it and storing it on their more desolate corners of their particular land. And then, of course, they discover that their children are developing birth defects or their groundwater is polluted and so on. The same thing is happening again with the whole issue of fracking. Now, I'm not an engineer. I can't tell you whether fracking is viable or not, but I can tell you that on several occasions that have been well documented, the small amount of oil and shale gas and so on that has been extracted has been delightful, I'm sure, but it has come at a terrible cost of polluting and destroying groundwater for perhaps many hundreds of years from now. Why is it that the ego says, if I can make a dollar today, I don't care if I render this land unusable for 200 years? It's a mind trap that we've got ourselves into. That's not living from the heart. That's not living from the place of respecting the nature that we are all linked to. And as such, it's a terrible lesson that we look at every day that asks us, are you going to keep doing this until there is no world left to do this to?
Yes. And I have to believe that, you know, we're supported in a way that it's not going to happen, that we're waking up, that somehow that's the purpose, that this is happening to wake us up. And, you know, something that I have heard said about the law of attraction, I myself have said it in the way that it can be interpreted, it's so me, and that can go up to we, and this isn't a misconception about it, is that I want this. You know, if I want, you know, three yachts and I want servants in a mansion or whatever, you know, envision this, the life of the rich and famous, so to speak. Not that the rich and famous are that happy, but I've seen this. And what does that then do to our world? You know, you get to have whatever you want. You can have, you know, you can oppress all these people, or, you know, it's very contrary to what I believe it actually is. And it's a huge misconception that I'm not just me. We're everybody together, and we have to know that. And that's exactly what you're saying. And yet it really goes against the grain of what I feel is a great misconception about the law of attraction, that I can have anything I want and say it just like that, too, very selfishly. You know, whatever I want, I get. and it's not that's not very love-based, is it? So I wonder if you could reflect on that some more.
Oh, yes, indeed. The law of attraction exists. It works. It works over and over again. And unless we understand what is meant by the law of attraction, we're going to be disappointed. And I think a lot of people, for instance, who listened to or watched Rhonda Byrne's The Secret, and who've read those books and listened to the CDs, many people got a slightly slanted message. And, you know, I'm not trying to put anybody down, because the message is whatever the message is, but people heard it perhaps the wrong way, and exactly the way you described, They said, oh, if I want three yachts, then all I have to do is imagine it and it will come. If I want that job paying those high six figures, then all I have to do is imagine it and it will come. It's not quite as simple as that. The law of attraction, or perhaps a better way to describe it is the law of manifestation, has been written about extensively by many people, and it certainly exists in the in Hindu religion. The Bhagavad Gita has got it, and the Upanishads have got it, and that's putting things to about 4000 BC. But the law of attraction is not about what I want, because there are many things that my ego thinks that I want that actually I don't need. I don't need three yachts. I don't even need one yacht. Would I like one? Well, I don't know. I don't know that much about yachts. And yet, I promise you, there are lots of people out there who are using their willpower as hard as they can to amass as much money as they can so they can have a yacht to feed their ego.
Yeah.
And some of them will even get it. But that's not what the law of attraction is. The law of attraction is quite straightforward about this, and this is Esther and Jerry Hicks, this is Wayne Dyer, this is a whole series of very learned people, and it's also me.
Yeah.
What I've noticed about the law of attraction is that you don't manifest what you want in speech marks. You manifest who you are. Now, that's very different. If I can give an example here, what we get more of is what we allow ourselves to be. So if I am going to allow myself or ask myself to be a happy person, I'm going to be happy, and I think anybody will recognize that the happy person in an organization, in a neighborhood, is the person who draws more happiness to him or her. People say, oh, you know, Bill's great. I always feel good when I'm with Bill, and the happiness grows. We attract and we manifest more happiness in that way. Now, that's rather different than, for instance, the person who says, if I had enough money, but I don't, I would buy a really, really sharp-looking car, and then I'd impress all the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
What that person is radiating is, I am short of money and a fast car, and I am short of the ability to impress people. That's what the person is radiating. And so the universe says, oh, you're radiating the fact that you are short of money and you are short of a car and you're short of respect. Okay, I'll give you more of what you're radiating.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, we know that's true. We know that that works that way because I'm sure we've all been at a public occasion when there's some person who's sitting in the corner scowling and being rude. And guess what? Everybody avoids that person. And so the miserable person generates more misery for him or herself. And occasionally someone will go along and talk to the miserable person and say, oh, you know, come join in the fun. And maybe the person can change. Or maybe the person says, go away, you know, you're all silly. In which case, that person has just generated more misery, has manifested more misery for him or herself. So what we do, the attitude that we bring to how we live, replicates itself over and over and over. Of course, we'll come across people who feel the opposite, but on the whole, we will replicate joy if we feel joyous. We'll replicate love if we're loving. And when we do that, when we attract and attract more of this good stuff to us, riches are not as important. Maybe we'll attract riches too, but they won't be important to us. If you're truly happy, it's nice to have a yacht, but so what? So what if you don't have one? The happiness, any rich person will tell you that happiness is by far the most precious quality. It's nice to be rich, but it's nicer to be happy, and that transcends all class and monetary brackets. So, you know, the secret suggested that we could get anything we wanted, and most people tended to hear that as, I can get all the things that will make my ego feel good.
Yes.
And that's really the mistake, because I think what Rhonda Byrne meant, I hope she meant, and I've seen the movie and I've read the book and I've been looking very carefully at this, I think what she meant was that exactly what I've been saying, that whatever attitude you bring to the world is what you will get more of. But
yeah.
Somehow that message didn't come across. In fact, I read the other day that one of the people who was working with Rhonda Byrne is now suing her for something like $300 million over
yes,
the secret.
Yes, I heard something on that,
and,
yes.
Yeah, well, you know, the online sources can be good,
good,
and sometimes they can be less than good.
Yeah, well,
who
knows? So we better be careful. Let's not spread rumors.
We better be
But no, I think I heard something on that a while ago, but assuming
yes.
That's true. But yes, so what would that mean then? Yes,
well, you know, she has manifested a lot of money, but she's
yeah.
also manifested a lot of conflict.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's worth saying that she's manifested a lot of people who are disappointed as a result of misunderstanding what she
That's
put
true.
Forward.
You know, I've known
and
a lot
you know,
of
Yeah,
go
yeah.
ahead. Well, it leads
Please,
to
go
frustration,
ahead.
Intense frustration.
Yeah.
Let me just throw that into the mix. I have known many people in the spiritual community who believe that they have a catalog in front of them and can order anything they want. In fact, it's often described
yeah.
that way, that you have this catalog, and, you know, car, boat, six planes, or whatever. You know, I've heard
yes.
it, but, or even, and not everyone in the spiritual community wants that, but there's this feeling of, you know, real frustration, you know, when it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and then a question, and, you know, one other thing that comes up as you're speaking, when I think about the people who say, I need a car to impress my neighbors, which tends not to be someone in the spiritual community, unless they're just there to impress people, which those people do exist.
Well,
I don't see a lot of love for oneself. You know, I keep seeing, I love your pentacles, Alan. The gratitude pentacle has become a very fundamental tool for me. It's always, it just arises in my head a lot because I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, you know, someone who says, and this is a compassionate way of looking at it, the way you often do, I need this to impress people, well, they don't love themselves. And so, you know, if they could only work on finding that love for themselves, they wouldn't want for those things. There would be no need to impress one's neighbors.
Yeah.
And then you come right back to that core you talk
yes.
about.
Oh,
and if we can only find it.
Yes, that's beautiful. The ego is all about not loving yourself, and certainly it's about not trusting that the universe will love us back. And that's why we need, or we think we need, all of these glittery toys, and why they're so important to some of them, and why they're so consoling, at least for a very short period of time, until we realize that we still don't feel loved. And so we have to go out and buy some more things. So yes, you are absolutely right there. And I'm so glad you mentioned the pentacle of gratitude, because, you know, the 5 points are the first one is, of course, feeling gratitude, feeling glad to be alive. And then the next point on that pentacle is 5-pointed star, with the points all interlinking, which I think is a wonderful metaphor for how these 5 qualities blend together. But the second point is humility.
Yes.
And humility is not a place where ego really exists. Humility says, oh, this is not about me. This is not about whether I die with the most toys. This is about something else. And humility says, oh, I'm here to do something loving for this world. And whatever is true for you, and it's going to be slightly different for each of us, whatever is true of our core selves, we will need to use that in all humility. That is, not expecting a reward. And when we give up looking for the results of what we do, but we offer what we do as almost a sacrifice to the world, that's true humility. And it's also, you know, good Buddhism and good Hinduism, those ancient religions that said, let go of results, do your best, let go of results. That's all you can ever do. You can't guarantee anything. But when you're in that space, it's difficult to get into the ego space again. So we may do whatever it is we do, but we to benefit the world, but we must not expect anybody to come along and pat us on the back immediately afterwards. That's what I call false charity. The person who rushes forward and says, look what a big check I'm giving. Look. And by the way, can you put my name on this building of this this organization and everybody will know how much I've given? Well, guess what? Giving like that carries its own message with it. The spirit in which you give something always matters. You know, I've sat in railway stations in odd corners of the world with some very humble people, and people have said, oh, you're hungry? Here, have half of my loaf of bread.
Yes.
And in real terms, that's just a piece of bread which cost a couple of pence, and it might not even have been very good bread. But in terms of the gift being given, that came from the heart. I've never forgotten some of those generous, spontaneous gestures from people who were far, far poorer in physical terms than me, and probably always would be poor. But they said, oh, here is a stranger, doesn't know where to get the bread, have some of mine. And suddenly, we've got a different slant on things. And that's coming from the heart, that's coming from the place of the person who is grateful, says, I've got a loaf of bread, that means I can give some to other people who need it. How great is that?
Yes.
And often this goes through the whole of the Christian story, the whole of the Jesus story, you know, that whole business, that strange miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. And in the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus gets all these people to sit down in little groups, and there are, there are 5 loaves and 2 fishes, or...
I'm going to get in trouble now.
I think that's it. I think it's
5 loaves
and 2 fishes.
I'm supposed to know this, having been to Bible school. Well, I didn't go to Bible school, but I went to Sunday school a lot. I should know.
Oh, well, I'll rely on you to tell me if I'm wrong.
Because I may get it wrong. That's what I'm saying. Now you're making me draw a blank, and I should know it. But yes, we know that
it's 5 loaves.
I think so.
And some people say, well, gosh, you know, that's a miracle. How can 5 loaves and 2 fishes feed 5,000 people? But I was discussing this with some folks, and someone said, well, you know, they're out in the middle of the desert, and they're all hungry, and they're all ordinary village people, practically all of them. So of course they would have brought their own food with them. Of course they would. They weren't stupid. They would have brought a bottle of water and a little something to eat. And what Jesus did was he sat them down in little groups and said, this is what we've got. We will share with you our little, with the implicit message, if you are loving too, you will share with those who are sitting in your little circle. And that's exactly what they did. And so it's not so, if we look at it as a miracle, it's like, oh, you know, how wonderful, gosh, you know, Jesus can wave his hands in the air and do the impossible. If we look at it that way, it's interesting. But if we look at it in terms of a message about the goodness of people, it becomes, I think, far more powerful, where Jesus looks at these people and says, you know, this is the way human beings need to be. Not just each of us chewing on our own little sandwich and sipping at our own little water bottle, but if we all share, look how much we've got. That's a loving message, and that is a different message. And that's, to get right back to where we started, that's a message of gratitude, of connection, and of humility and look at how wonderful it is. Look at what that generates. That's a miracle. That's a real miracle to me.
Yes. Yes. It's so true. And, you know, as you were talking about your story of the sandwich, I was thinking of another biblical story, the widow's mite. I mean...
Yes, that's a beautiful one, isn't it?
There's another lesson. Oh, a beautiful story. And yes. I've observed this among people, that the less they have, it gives people compassion. I know this myself, having walked away from my, you know, corporate job long ago. I mean, it's not to say I'm to the point of sitting on a bench giving someone a sandwich, but it's not like that. I have had people, gosh, I hope not, but I have such compassion. I mean, but honestly, in this economy, I've known many people who have lost their homes and, you know, people firsthand in very real distress and really practically, you know, very much in that situation. And, you know, all you want to do is help those people. And, you know, the less you have, I see people who have very little helping others because there's tremendous compassion because, you know, there's kind of that we're all in this together kind of attitude that can happen even among the unemployed. We have people who listen during the day who may be, you know, among the unemployed. And I so relate to that feeling, but it can really result in a lot of empathy and compassion. And like the widows.
Yes. Oh, yes, that's a wonderful example, isn't it? I mean, that's love. That's people loving each other, loving their neighbors as themselves. And we know that the, you know, that parable of the widow's mite, the little old lady who has just a tiny coin to give and yet gives it from her heart. We can see that's true any day of the week. I can think right now of some young people I knew who growing up, they had very wealthy relatives who would send them big checks, but they would never come and see them. And those big checks might have been great on birthdays. You know, oh, you know, here, buy yourself something nice. But those children were blessed because they had neighbors who might have had no presents to give them on their birthday, but who were able to give them love. I'm thinking of a couple of families who live just not far from here.
Yes.
And the neighbor was there, was present, was there to wipe away tears, was there to be happy when happy events happened. And that is valued by those children who grew up into be fine adults, that was valued by them far more than any large check that came through the mail with a fancy card that said, here, buy yourself something nice. You know, it's the spirit in which giving happens that is so important. It's the love that is important.
You know, something else when we think about even, you know, how are we living in a responsible way in love for our fellow human beings. I think that, you know, when you don't, one of my lessons has been personally is falling out of the consumption culture in that this business of, oh, there's a little tear on the corner of that sheet. Time to go buy new sheets. Or, you know, just about anything. Like, I'm tired of that couch. And I was never rich. I mean, I would never even close to saying that. But, I mean, I made a good wage in the corporate world, for sure. And now, I don't even think about, I mean, I don't, you know, if we don't need something, we don't get it. I mean, there's not this business of, oh, you know, I mean, I, you know, I just see something and buy it. And we don't think about the impact on the world. I mean, yes, we may be employing people who are making the sheets. I mean, I guess you got to think about that. It's a balance. I mean, sometimes you do want to buy things. However, if we become wasteful in our consumerism, at which great wealth, which I've never seen, but great wealth could result in, depending on how we use it, that's not really being a good caretaker for the planet. That is not living in a truly loving way. And we probably should get back to the whole flow and the path of how we want our lives to go, you know, how we choose to live and,
yes.
and what's compatible with that.
Yes, that's a beautiful example. And, you know, if only more people thought the way you do, it seems as though we are obsessed with material culture. But it's, again, you know, it gets right back to this idea that can we stop for a moment and say, it's not about what I can get, but what I can give.
Yeah.
Now, that's what we're saying. It's possible to spend a lot of time looking through the online catalogs or the print catalogs, deciding what we want to get. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of choosing and talking to our neighbors and is this a better product than that, or therefore which one shall I buy? You can spend a lot of energy doing that, and many people do. But you can use the same energy by looking inward and saying, okay, who am I? Who am I really at my loving core? And what can I give? And that's a very different question. And people may say, well, actually, you know, I'm good with children, so perhaps I can give my energy to being a daycare provider or whatever. Oh, wonderful. We need first-class daycare people. Of course we do. These are the youngest and most tender people to join our community.
Uh-oh. I just heard something cut off on the line. I don't know if Alan can
Generous
hear me.
Way.
Oh, there we are.
Oh, can you hear me?
You cut out
okay.
for a second. Just for a second.
Oh,
I don't
I'm
know
sorry
what happened,
about that.
But you're back. No, it's not your fault. It
okay.
just seemed to have cut off for a second, but we're back.
Oh. okay, well, I'll speak slightly,
think where
slightly
I lost
louder.
You. It was only for about 30, like 15 seconds, and now I have to...
Oh, okay. Well, it's about giving back, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that means looking inward, finding out what is true of who you are from the loving core of who you are, and then saying, can I give back from that space? Now,
yes.
We have been trained to say, can I use what I'm good at to get money? And now I think that's an old, old paradigm. It doesn't work anymore. It hasn't worked for a number of years for many people. So it's a very good idea, it seems to me, to pause and say, this is who I am. These are the skills that I have, because we all have skills. Some of those skills may seem slightly humble, but they are still skills. And then we have to say, I need to give selfless service. Again, that's part of some of the very ancient holy scripts from the Bhagavad Gita and so on. How do I give selfless service back to this world that has so generously given me life and breath and room to be and possibilities? And that's a form of gratitude, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's what we need to do.
Yes.
And so you know when we do that...
Go ahead.
Sorry?
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, when we do that, and I apologize here if I keep jumping
right.
forward
no,
because
good.
You raise
no.
such good questions.
Good.
when we go into that personal space and say, what's true of the deepest part of me and how can I use it, that is when we invite ourselves to enter the flow. And the flow is where synchronicities happen. And when we say, gosh, you know, this is who I truly am. I have an ability to work with animals. I have an ability to carve wood. I have an ability to be an exquisitely fine radio show host, for instance. And these abilities may not appear, we may not recognize them for a number of years, but when we see them, when we say, oh, I seem to be pretty good at this, that's when we have to say, I can't walk past this. I must use this talent for a positive purpose. In your case, you use your talent to nurture discussions like this over the airwaves. And 100 years ago, we couldn't have had discussions like this in our world because the airwaves were not usable. And yet now the discussions are growing worldwide. People are waking up and thinking new thoughts.
Yes.
So using our talents is absolutely essential for moving humanity forward to where it needs to be, rather than perhaps looking at the glossy brochures for new cars and new yachts.
Yes. Yes. You know, one of the things that I've seen happen, and like even with this radio show, which I don't claim to be the most polished radio show I host. I just get out here and start talking, you know. I don't know. I mean, it just is what it is. But I will tell you, I have encountered opposition. Like, why are you spending so much time on that? It's not bringing in much money. I mean, it brings in a tiny, tiny little bit, you know, of advertising revenue. It's no living wage. I mean, it's a work, because I want to do it, because I love to do it, and I keep coming back to it. And so, but you can run into, and this is in your synchronicity book, you can run into people who will question, why are you doing this illogical thing? Because it seems illogical. It seems like, you know,
yes,
I could be maybe coming up with any number of, you know, money-making ideas instead of reading the books that people bring to me, I could be, you know, coming up with ways to maybe get more revenue or whatever. And then for some reason, I just keep coming back to the core. You know, I want to be spending time with the guests. And I'm not presenting myself as some noble person either. I mean, there are probably things I could even do to maybe get the word out more about these guests. And so I'm not saying I'm doing everything perfectly, because I'm not. But just that thing, you got to be careful there. Even with the whole consumerism thing, that was learned through necessity. I mean, that was a hard lesson, let me tell you. I'm not being noble when I say I'm not going out and buying, you know, new sheets. It's because really, you know, I'm being very conservative with funds, you know, but it's been a lesson. So anyway, no perfection here. I want to be really careful. But, again, opposition, you know, and actually that may be a really good reason. Actually, that did come up recently. Like, you know, why don't I have new sheets? Somebody actually asked that in my household. And I said, well, we can go get some. I mean, it's not as if I'm not going to get them. But the thing is no, you know, I've had to make some sacrifices. And I know other people who make sacrifices to follow an artistic path, a creative path, or a spiritual past their passion, and this radio show just kind of came up from out of nowhere, blindsided me, and never in a million years would I have guessed I'd be doing this. And yet
there
I am.
Are. Yes. Yes, and it's a very, very fine fit for who you are and what you believe, which is why it came into your life. It's why you manifested it. It's almost as though the universe said, you know, Susan's got things to say. What's the best way that she can get them said? And the best way, I think, or for now, the best way seems to be able to put on a radio show in which you can choose what discussions emerge, where you're not dominated perhaps by a corporate legislature which tells you what to do. And this is absolutely at the core of moving into the different space, the space of attraction, the law of attraction can work, and so that manifestation can work. And yet, we all know that, you know, when we go to grade school, our teachers, God bless them, they want us to learn certain things, but they also want us to pass the standardized tests. They want us to do well in the eyes of the world, in a measurable way, because that's the way they get hired or fired.
Yeah.
If a class performs well on the tests, they get to stay in their job, which they love, because of course, you know, teachers do tend to love their jobs for the most part.
Yeah.
And so they're caught between the genuine business of education, which means respecting every learner no matter where he or she is, and trying to bring that person forward, and the dictates of an outer body which is responsible to people who say, I want to know that my tax dollars are educating my children, and I want proof, which is a reasonable statement, except, of course, that those parents who want their children educated in a certain way are probably thinking in terms of the child getting, quote, a good job.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with wanting the best for your child. There's certainly nothing wrong with wanting the very best work possibilities for one's children. And yet, I have to tell you a little personal story. And that is, when I went through my school system in England, most of which was paid for, actually all of which up to the doctoral level was paid for by the government, because I could do well on the standardized tests, but there was enormous pressure on me from my parents, from my peers, from all of my professors. They said, go and be a lawyer. You will do well at this. You will make money.
Huh.
And I have a very long story, which I will save perhaps for another day, but I had a very embarrassing interview when I turned up at Oxford University to be admitted, because I had, at that point, I had applied to study law, and they were ready to admit me to study law. And I realized when I, 2 weeks beforehand, I said, that's not me. That's not true to the core of me. The core of me has to do with literature and a different type of exploration.
Yeah.
And so I turned up to the interview to meet two people, the head of the law department and the head of the English department, both of whom wanted to cross-examine me. Very scary. Now, if I'd played safe, I could have said, oh, you know, I really want to be a lawyer. You're prepared to let me in to be a lawyer. And I am convinced to this day that that is not who I am, and I would have been miserable.
Yeah.
Now, I've stuck to my guns, and it has shaped the life that I now live in ways that are just immeasurable. When I've told this story to people occasionally, as I do, you wouldn't believe the number of times people have then said, you know, something very similar happened to me. I was under huge pressure to be an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, or whatever. And then they said, and I decided I could not do that. And that's made all the difference. And when you come across people who say that to you, who look you in the eye and say, I could have made a lot of money, but I'm glad I chose what is true for me, that is, I think, when we learn a profound lesson. First is my struggle, I'm not alone. It's a struggle that everybody faces, the struggle between the ego world of pleasing the parents, of doing the right thing in society's eyes, and the heart world that says, you really have to live this way because it's true to who you are. And the sad thing is that most of us don't do that. Most of us, at least for large portions of our lives, don't do that. That's what the midlife crisis often is about. The midlife crisis is, in Joseph Campbell's words, you find that you've climbed to the top of your ladder and you realize the ladder is leaning up against the wrong wall.
Yes.
And that's what happens to so many people in my counseling practice. I get people who say, I'm successful in what I do and I feel hollow. And you think, oh, gosh, this is the heart saying, feed me, pay attention to me. And that is when we follow the path of the heart, that's when the synchronicities happen. The doors start to open that we thought could never open. The possibilities arise that we say, oh, I'm too old for that. And suddenly here's somebody saying, won't you join us in doing this or that? And that's when these strange things happen that make us think, gosh, you know, the universe has bigger plans for me than I had for myself. And that's magic when that happens. We realize we have ways that we can give back.
Yeah. You know, as you're speaking, I think of all of us who were diverted. I was diverted into engineering, as a matter of fact, because how are you going to...
Uh-huh.
I thought I was going to be a writer. But how are you going to keep a roof over your head? I'm sure you hear this a lot, Dr. Hunter.
Yes, yes.
With the writers you have under your care. Well, I could have been one of your students when I was 20 or someone much like your students. And yet, you know, I listened to others who felt that that was not a solid road. And I went into a very lucrative profession, I did. And I don't want to talk too much about me yet. The whole purpose here, though, is what's really interesting, is because I ended up getting a math degree, of all things, which was one of the hardest things I ever did in my life. It was very hard. It was very difficult. It challenged me greatly. But that has helped me now. It is amazing. And this, to me, is synchronicity right now. As I always thought to myself, why in the world did I end up doing this? And I thought it many times when I was in the program. Why am I doing this? Because it was hard and not really what I liked that much. And yet, it's like the little pieces of my past. And I'm sure, again, I don't want to speak too much about myself, but I want to generalize from this. It's as if even when you're diverted, it seems like you've been diverted, and yet it all comes full circle, that once you begin to find the flow, like now later in life, I'm really attempting to listen, and yes, I would like to write. It's one of the things my radio show has diverted me from writing a bit, but I'm setting my intent more to write.
Good.
I knew you would say good. All of my past, though, even the diversions of my past, are feeding that flow now. And it's like now suddenly I'm thankful. I'm thankful that I had this experience or that experience. And it's like, wow, look at that thread. Who would have thought that would lead to anything? You know, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And to me, that is synchronicity, and it comes back to gratitude. You know, you can now begin to say, huh, you know, maybe I should be thankful that happened. Maybe this was my path. I wasn't meant to do this all my life. I was meant to be an engineer and then switch. And you see, and so I know others are like this, right on the verge of some artistic path. Perhaps they're unemployed again. That, you know, I had a job end that I loved, and thought I could do in engineering, and it was communications-oriented, but it ended. And so then I ended up here. And, you know, again, the flow, like a river, it carried me, and it carries us all. And you talk about a river in your work, and how can we trust in that?
Well, that's it, isn't it? Nothing is wasted. I fervently believe that no experience is wasted as long as we stay alert. So your example there of, you know, you took the degree in mathematics, you became an engineer, and presumably there were times when you thought, how in the world am I ever going to use this? Well, guess what?
Yes.
You know, we can't predict that because the universe is bigger and more complicated and much more wonderful than we can really try to pin down in any little phrase we may come up with. It has plans for us. And as long as we're paying attention, we can use our abilities appropriately. But it's very much that idea of the river that you mentioned and the idea of being in the flow. You can swim upstream in a river. You can. It takes a lot of effort, and you probably won't get very far, but you can do it. We can all do it. Or we can say, goodness me, this is the way the river is flowing. Let me use my ability to float in the river and see where it takes me. And I think water is always a really interesting symbol, because water can drown you. If you don't take the effort to keep yourself afloat, if you don't make friends with this element that is uncertain, that is not within your control, if you fight it, it can drown you quicker. You know, the age-old story that was always told us when we were being taught to swim at school and so on is, if you come across someone who's in difficulties, the first thing you do to tell them when they're in difficulties, they're thrashing around, you say, relax. and then you tow them back to the shore.
Now,
when we're not relaxed in the water, we're fighting it every inch of the way because we think we have the answer. It ought to be this way. It's got to be this way because my ego says it's got to be this way. But when we look at what is, oh, this is a river, and being in a river requires certain things of me. I have to make friends with it. I have to operate in congruence with its laws. Not my laws. My laws, which I've created, ho, 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 you know, as a, as a frail human being, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. But if I observe the way my life is unfolding, then I can make sense of it. And Schopenhauer said very, very significantly in 19th century, of course, he said, you know, sometimes when we look back on our lives, that's the only time we can make sense of them, when we can see that there was something very similar to a guiding hand moving us through life. At the time, we couldn't see it, of course.
Yeah.
But looking back at it later, we can. Now, one of the things I do is I work with writers, of course, and I work with memoirists. And what happens over and over and over again, I can't begin to tell you how often it happens, because it seems to happen every time, is that memoirists that I work with look up from the stories that they are unearthing about their lives and say, good gracious, there's a pattern here. There is, this all seems to have happened for a reason. And I say, well, you have two ways to look at this. You know, you can look at it that you are inventing the pattern, which would be a mechanistic view, or you can say there was a pattern and that the universe is asking us to observe it so that we can be responsive to that pattern. And the universe will keep sending us hints. It will keep sending us hints. For writers, I think last time we spoke, I mentioned John Steinbeck, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And when he started off as a writer, he said, I'm going to write books that sell. And so he wrote historical romances, because everybody told him that that's what would sell. And he was absolutely, you know, nobody wanted his books at all.
Yeah.
When he abandoned that idea of what he thought he ought to do and said, I'm just going to write what comes from my heart about the things I see and the people who are all around me, when he started to do that, he not only changed his writing style, but he opened his heart. And that's where The Grapes of Wrath came from. That's where all of those great California novelettes of Monterey came from. That's where East of Eden came from. And that's what got him the Nobel Prize, because he was paying attention to the fact that the universe was saying, we don't want what you think you ought to offer. We want what is authentic to you. Tell us the stories that are authentic to you. And he never looked back from that point onwards. Now, that's the flow that we're talking about. In a world where there are market researchers on every corner, when there are people who will tell you that you must do this and this and this and this and this in order to be successful, this sounds like suicide. And yet we know.
Yes, very much.
We know. We see, we listen to our radios, and some band comes on and we say, wow, that's different. And you discover, of course, that you know the ones who are different, who are exciting, have been doing their own thing. They haven't come from the music conglomerate, which produces you know, just the cheerful sounds that are eminently forgettable. Those are the people who are working from their heart, who are in the flow, and the flow works for them, bringing them more opportunities. And when the opportunities arrive, and this is right down to the law of attraction, we have to choose carefully, because more possibilities will arise than we can ever take charge of. And some of those possibilities will not be true to the best part of ourselves. And that's when music makers and artists and writers, that's sometimes when they sell out, when they do what gets them money rather than what is absolutely vital to who they are. And that's a struggle for some of them. Just 2 weeks ago here in Boston, we had at the Museum of Fine Arts, we had some a wonderful exhibit of John Singer Sargent's paintings. He was active through the 1880s and into the early part of the 20th century. And Singer Sargent made a huge amount of money painting society pictures. Wonderful pictures of lords, mostly ladies, beautiful ladies in flowing white robes. Fantastic. He hated it. He hated it. This exhibit was of his watercolors, which is what he did the rest of the time when he wasn't churning out these beautiful, high-priced pictures. And the watercolors are free and exuberant and joyous, and you stand in front of them and you let them work on you and you think, oh my goodness, this may not have got him a gazillion dollars, but look at the life and look at the way it makes me feel as I look at it. You could look around at the people there, and they were all very excited. You know, and I've got this on good authority. It's not just me who's saying this. There were others who were observing this. And this is a man who, as it were, had his day job, which paid big bucks, but didn't lose sight of what his real job was, which was to respond to this marvelous beauty in the world he saw around him and to honor it by painting the pictures. Now that is someone who has got the balance of being in the flow but also perhaps making sure the bills get paid. And it works for all of us. We have to walk this nice edge of, well, you know, I must put food on the table, and I must also honor my spiritual self.
Yeah.
And I have to do both.
Yes. So yes, I think that requires balance. It really does. And it's not easy to figure that out, because there can be a tendency of, I'm just going to follow my heart. You know, I've been through this.
Yes.
And yet you can't just do that. I mean, you can, but you have to at least know that you're in the world. This is a lesson I'm learning right now, you know, how to navigate through the world doing your passion and pay the bills. And, you know, it's working so far, but it does take trust if you're not in one of these, you know, big corporate jobs where you're totally, not to say people can't be fulfilled in a corporate job. There are people who are, but, you know, if you're not doing something just for the money, you know, just for the money, and so it takes trust, it seems, and it's a learning experience for us all.
Yes, it is, absolutely. And we all are going to have different learning experiences handed to us, because I do believe that the universe is here to help us grow our souls, or perhaps better, to help us know what our souls are. And so we are going to have trust, as you say. We're going to have patience. And some of us discover that what we love to do pays enormous amounts of money, and so we can do that all the time. Some of us are going to. And that's their learning. That is learning for those people. The rest of us are going to have a different learning lesson, because we can observe it around us all the time. For me, you know, I have my teaching job during the day, which I love doing, and there are some aspects of it I don't love doing. You know, some of the administrative stuff, of course, you know, I complain about. And then I can get to do my writing. And there are some aspects of that are heavy lifting as well. But all of this is part of the learning that I need if my soul is going to grow, is going to fulfill itself. And I think that's what we're here for. And the best way, of course, to grow your soul is through love, learning how to be loving. And that doesn't mean being soft. It doesn't mean giving in to everybody. It means sometimes you have to be very tough with people. And so that's a balance as well. But the learning, the opportunity to learn, is always there, and it's going to be different for each and every one of us. And for some of us, it will be very hard. I have enormous amounts of compassion for those people who have lost their jobs, whose houses perhaps are on the brink of being repossessed.
Yes.
And this, I can't imagine personally how absolutely gut-wrenching that must be. I have enormous compassion for such difficult circumstances. I was close to such circumstances at one point in my life, and it was very frightening when I was ill, which is what I talk about in Gratitude and Beyond. It was very frightening, and yet it was also a learning growth point for me. It broke open my heart in ways that I'm forever grateful for. Was it an easy lesson? Good Lord, no. Would I wish it on anyone else? Well, only from the point of view of what I was able to learn, not from the point of view of how hard it was to learn it. It's a balancing act. Just as floating in the river takes some effort, and we may have to do a certain amount of swimming to get around those rocks before they smash us. And it may be hard work, and it may be very cold in that river, but we have to cooperate with it and remain true to ourselves. So, you know, I think this is a whole discussion that, as it were, comes round back to itself in exactly the way you described.
Yes, this concept. I am so happy that you brought up the breaking open experience. Is that, you know, when we, and Gratitude and Beyond does provide just a beautiful view into your life and how you experience this, and yet it does show up for all of us at some point. And then you can look back and actually be thankful, even though it was painful. And that's the key. And so this concept, and in fact, I think it's helpful, too, as we're encountering things that don't quite go the way we want. Even now, you know, there may be, all of us have things that we're thinking, you know, why isn't this working? Or maybe it's something really challenging going on. And if you can look at it from the standpoint of, well, maybe I'm supposed to break open some more, you know, and know that that actually benefited you in the past, and you see examples of people who are benefited, like you, Alan, and so it's a powerful. It runs contrary to the conventional wisdom about the law of attraction that it's all going to be perfect always, and yet however you view it is perfect, and yet that's the whole point: is it actually is perfect in its imperfection? It's there's something very perfect to it when you know that there's a plan, there's a pattern. So yes, very, very powerfully we're integrating these concepts. I'm just so happy to see us doing this. The various threads of your work coming together here in this program today, which is really kind of cool to listen. So anyway, it is. And they come together really beautifully, Alan, how these concepts flow into each other. And we're heading into the last 7 minutes of the show. It's gone by really fast, as usual.
It does go by fast, doesn't it?
It does. But, you know, so powerfully, you've brought us back to where we need to be here, and that's that space of the heart. Whether broken open or listening, we are in that space of the heart when we're in the flow.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And the breaking open, when we talk about heartbreak, and I like to think in terms of hearts being broken open, because sometimes we protect or we mask our hearts with this heavy screen of the ego, and that's what needs to be broken through so that our hearts can open. It's almost as though they are constricted by the ego. So yes, but I'm so pleased that we're able to make these connections here, Susan, and much gratitude to you for allowing me on the show to make the connections in the way you've described, because all of these ideas, the law of attraction, manifestation, synchronicity, the flow, they all are interconnected, and they are all to do with the path of the heart, which starts with gratitude.
Yeah.
And I think that's really an important place to start.
Yes, yes. And, you know, certainly I feel gratitude to you for bringing, you know, such a powerful message to the show and your presence and how fully you come to your work. I think all of us who appreciate your work, Alan, is we appreciate how it's very much an expression of your own authenticity. You bring yourself into all of your work and your stories and your path, and it just flows beautifully to all of us. And I know that I express what the audience feels to those who are following all these programs that you've been doing and your work, that we're very much in a space of gratitude and how you're helping us. You are helping us to find that flow for ourselves, you know, really be authentically on that path. So a very sincere thank you to you for coming here and having such amazing discussions, which we all enjoy.
Well, you're very, very kind, and I think I should be the one who is thanking you for allowing me the space. And perhaps I'll just add one thing, and that is, you know, I have these 12 books in the world, and I'm continuing to write. But
good.
One of the things I have to say about each of these books is each one of them came along, as it were, and tugged at my sleeve and kicked my shins and said, come on, write me.
Yes.
And on each occasion I said, go away. You know, I want to have a quiet, nice time. You know, I want to watch the ball game on TV. And they wouldn't stop bothering me until I'd written them.
Yeah.
And so I think that I try to be authentic. It's not easy, of course. Nobody can manage it all the time. And I also try to honor the flow. And these books, I think, are my humble offering from my experience of being in the flow and finding this material coming to me and saying, it's your job to do something with it. And I think that's what the universe wants of all of us. It wants us to use what we've got for everyone's benefit. So thank you for pointing that out, and thank you for having me on the show again. It's just so delightful to chat with you.
Yes, well, it's been a true joy, and, you know, let me say at the end, in all humility as well, I thank you to Blog Talk Radio today, because they have been featuring this show the entire time it's been on, live, on the Spirituality page.
Oh, lovely.
And I'm very thankful to them and for how that will help this message get out even more, because they, too, assess these messages, you know, what the audiences need to hear in spirituality.
Yes.
And I'm so very thankful, sincerely, that our show ended up being in that slot today. So...
Me
and
too.
Thankful to
you. Oh, gratitude.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, lovely.
So, and I'm thankful to Blog Talk Radio. This has been a wonderful environment for this show, and I really do have tremendous gratitude for everything that's come together. We're moving into the very end of the live show. Let me remind people they can find your website again at alanhunter.net with two L's, A-L-L-A-N, hunter.net. It's on the page, but not everyone can see the page when they listen. And I will probably put the pentacles back up on the page. And also out there, there is a link to all of your shows. And I want people to know that, because we've really built to an interesting place here today. And I think there are those who are new who may like to listen to those shows, and I really invite you to do so. Listen and discover the work of Alan Hunter. There are wonderful books out there. I've got you scheduled to come back on February 28th, I believe, and we're going to talk same time, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, the Healing Brothers or the healing power of the Grimm Brothers tales is what we're going to talk about. Your book, Princess Frogs and Ugly Sisters, is our plan. And real quick, before the live show goes down, next show is Saturday night. Got to think quick here. It's this Saturday, February 1st, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, A Night of Numerology with Rob Ragazine. He's returning to the show, so just wanted to get that out. And thank you to the live audience who are leaving us right now. And we'll wrap up here in the podcast really quick. Just another thank you to you, Alan. I can't say it enough.
Thank you, Susan.
I have gratitude and beyond right in front of me. I have all your books just laid out in front of me, and just always drawn back. And this felt like being in college to me. I really enjoyed this discussion. It reminds me of when, you know, you used to be in a class with a professor and really get going on a topic. So I really enjoyed it today.
Oh, good.
So thank you again.
Me too, Susan. Me too. And thank you. Thank you for all you do.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And you take care, and I look forward to the next time that you come on.
So do I.
Okay, well, wonderful. Take care, Alan. It's good to talk with you.
And you too, Susan. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Okay, just a few final notes to the podcast audience, and a welcome to those of you in the podcast. I always welcome the energy across time because you've been with us all along, and I certainly recognize that. You're here with us, sharing in this time together. Just a few notes. You can learn all about the schedule for this show on frontierbeyondfear.com. Just wanted to note an upcoming appearance. I'm actually going to be at the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo, and that's sneaking up fast because I'm going to be at booth 706, February 7th through 9th. It's at the Hilton LAX in Los Angeles. And if you're in the area, if you're coming in from out of town for that expo, please do come by my booth and just say hello. I tend to have a very open booth. You never know what's going on at my booth. It's mostly just meeting and greeting and talking and sharing with people. I really hope to see you there. And then I'm also going to be speaking on Heaven on Earth on Sunday, February 9th at 6 p.m. at the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo. And I'm really looking forward to that. And I hope to be doing more workshops in the coming year. I have another expo planned in Portland, Body, Mind, Spirit Expo in April. I'll put out the dates, and I'll put all that up on the frontierbeyondfear.com page to make sure you can see, you know, what might be going on locally and occasionally out of town, though usually I'm in the Portland area is where I work. So thank you so much, everyone, for being here today. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. And I do really invite you, do go out and explore Dr. Alan G. Hunter's work some more, because there is true depth and authenticity there. And trust me, it will really help you in your own lives in so many different ways. And I can personally attest to that, how it's helped me continue to stay on track with my flow as much as I can manage. And so I am very thankful for his work as well. So everyone, thank you very much. And whenever this show finds you, I hope you have a wonderful day, evening, whenever you're listening. And I will see you next time. ¶¶